This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So is it true or not true that you don't like blood?
Well, I don't like seeing my own blood, that's for sure.
We brought it up earlier. We were at NBC's press day for Fear Itself.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm a total sissy. I am completely. If it's real blood, forget it. I'll pass out.
So you saw the film last night. What was this film for you? Was it an exercise in just a character piece? Was it trying to play around with a story, a narrative based on
around?
Well, no. But I mean, like taking something from the headlines and embellishing on it. And so, I mean, what was this for you? Because I think it's a very interesting experiment after something like Edmund, because you're keeping everything very varied. So.
Well, it was one of those stories that I was reading about in the newspaper every day. You know, this story was a big story. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was about 3 or 4 years ago. It was when she was on trial. It was like on the front page every day for weeks. And I was just sitting there reading and going, oh my God, I can't believe this. It was like, you know, impossible to comprehend. You know, that a girl who was a caregiver at a senior citizen home was taking some guy and letting him bleed to death in her garage. So, you know, that was what grabbed me. And I was thinking, this is an ordinary person. This is not some weirdo monster character. This is, you know, a regular day-to-day kind of person behaving in a incredibly cold and heartless way. You know, what happened?
So you didn't have to change much from the original story just for kind of, you know, to make it a movie, obviously. Like, how much did you have to change?
We didn't change much. I mean, you know, I would say the first half of the movie is pretty accurate, really, in terms of what really went down. You know, she did, immediately after she put him in her garage, go and have sex with her boyfriend. That really did happen. You know, that was one of the details that kind of jumped out at me when I was reading about it. And, you know, where we kind of departed from the truth was with the idea of him getting himself out of the windshield, because Gregory Biggs, the man that this actually happened to, never did get out. But it was we did several drafts where we followed the real sort of timeline of the story. And at one point, I remember John Strizek, the screenwriter, said, "Well, what if he tries to get out? It makes his character more, you know, having your character become active rather than just a passive victim. Things started happening in the story." You know, that last act just kind of wrote itself.
Did you have to keep those sort of outrageous moments? Because it is still a Stuart Gordon movie, like the dog licking the phone and crazy stuff like that. The fight in the hallway with Brian.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think one of the reasons that scene with the frying pan works so well is because it's the first time in the movie that she kind of takes the initiative. You know, up until that point, she is kind of asking him to help, or you've got to help me, you've got to take care of this. And all of a sudden, she becomes empowered. And I think the reason that we like that scene so much is because she is, you know, she's becoming active.
But the outrageous gore moments, you still have to throw those in for your fans?
I never think of it as throwing anything in for my fans. I kind of think of them as just like, this is what could happen next, you know. You know, we were talking about, you know, when we're working on this, what are some of the obstacles that this guy could encounter? You know, because initially, in talking to John Strizek, it was like, is there enough material here for a movie? You know, you sort of describe this to somebody, and they go, well, that sounds like you could do maybe 20 minutes, you know, on that story. So we started coming up with ideas for things that could happen, and things like the dog or the you know, the family, the immigrants, you know, who are afraid of being deported, you know, those kinds of ideas. You know, none of that really happened in the real story, but, you know, it seemed like something that could happen.
What about the windshield wiper? Was that real?
No. As far as I know, it wasn't. Although, it was in reading the real sort of description of his injuries, they said that one of his legs, he was almost completely amputated, that he was like, you know, it was... You know, there was not much left of one of his legs, so the windshield wiper was not something that was real. It was something that we kind of invented, but it was not that different from the reality.
How about the details leading up to the crash with him in the park? Was he pushing a cart? Was that all?
Well, no, that was not really true. I mean, the question was, and it was funny because it came up really late in the game, was how does she know that he's a homeless guy? That was really the question. She hits this guy, and she says to her boyfriend, "I hit a homeless guy." How does she know he's homeless? And so finally, the idea came: oh, he's got to be pushing a cart. And so, well, where did he get the cart? You know, and we had to work the whole thing through. The real story, it was interesting because John Strzyzik actually went to the site where the accident took place, you know, in Fort Worth, and it's out in the middle of nowhere. It's like it's a highway. It's not unlike the movie, it's not like an intersection, you know, in a city. It's out in the middle of nowhere. It's a highway, and the question we all still have is, what the hell was he doing out there? You know, why was he there in the first place? You know. You know, no one knows.
You cast Mina Suvari as your lead, and you would work with her in Edmund. What did you, why? Like working with the experience the first time?
I had a great time working with her, you know, and the thing that I hadn't realized about Mina until, you know, after working with Edmund was that she really likes, she loves horror. You know, she's really a fan, and she really knows it well. And it was funny, when we were shooting the movie, every weekend she would be going to see whatever horror movie was opening that weekend. You know, she'd go, "You want to come with?" And I'd go, "You know, I really don't think I can, but let me know if it's any good." You know,
I saw, when I was growing up, I saw your films on video because they wouldn't play in the theaters in general places where I lived. Do you have an eye towards making movies that have more of a theatrical marketability these days?
Well, you know, you always would like to see your movie play in, you know, the theater, because that's always, you know, they're designed for audiences. You know, when the problem, you know, the only thing I have against people watching your movie on DVD is that it takes away some of the fun of being in an audience and seeing it with a group of people. But, you know, the important thing is that people see it at all, you know, and 90% of all movies are seen on DVD. You know, it's kind of rare for anything to get a theatrical release. The bigger the audience, the better is always the way I feel. But I'm glad that people are watching them at all.
Well, this is, and Edmund was also.
Yeah, I mean, some of the, you know, the other, my other films got theatrical releases, but the kind of stuff I do is not the kind of stuff that, you know, a studio is going to put out on 4,000 screens. You know.
Do you have one that you'd like to do that would be more in that line?
I actually do. It's a pirate movie, which I've been trying to get made forever. You know, it was every time I would be about ready to get this movie made, there would be a terrible pirate movie that would open up, and that would be the end of it. You know, and now finally, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, a successful pirate movie. Maybe I've got a shot.
Well, you dipped your hand in the kids movie market a while ago, didn't you?
Yeah, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
How was that?
It was an interesting experience. I mean, it was funny because people always say, "Well, that's so different from your other films." But in reality, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids is a horror film. You know, it's got giant bugs in it. It's got a mad scientist. It's, you know, got a terrible experiment that goes wrong. You know, it's got all the ingredients of a horror movie. And it was funny because it took Disney a while to sort of realize that, and then they got really scared, and they said, Stuart, you know, we would really like this to be more like The Absent-Minded Professor and less like The Fly.
So what does that mean for your pirate movie?
Well, the pirate movie is not a Disney pirate movie. I mean, it's a... I like to think of it as a pirate movie that Sergio Leone would make. You know, it's a very sort of violent, tough, you know, hard-ass pirate movie. So
it was nice to see your wife.
Yeah, it was great to see her, to be working with her again.
Yeah. Was she excited?
Well, she was a little upset that I didn't murder her, though.
You suffer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You made her really mean, though.
Well, she's always mean. No, I shouldn't say that. She actually, it's funny, I don't know, because she's the sweetest lady in the world, if you've ever met her. But, you know, I always keep casting her as these terrible bitches. And the... There was one review of Dolls that came out, and they described her as bitch-tastic. So I've been using that, you know, adjective a lot around the house. So, yeah, you're just bitch-tastic, honey.
I have a technical question about the fire scene. How much of that was a stunt person, and at what point did you cross over? I was wondering if some animatronics were used, because you usually don't see someone burn quite that long while they're still moving. So do you have the bravest stuntman in the world?
I'll say some of it was actually Mina Suvari, and that she, you know, she actually did set herself on fire for part of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's true.
But by the point where it's completely engulfed, and you're still seeing.
Yeah. No, that was a pretty great burn.
It's a stuntman.
Yeah, it's a stunt woman actually.
That's a long.
Yeah. She was terrific, and you know, it was a really good. The stunt team on this was great. I mean, the guy going through the windshield is real. You know, it's not a dummy or a CG or anything. That's real. And we, you know, had to do it several times. You know, so.
So you used candy glass or something, or how did you
know? It wasn't candy. It was like a hard plastic, like styrene plastic of some kind, I guess. Very, very brittle. The problem we had was shipping the stuff to St. John. We had something like 11 windshields, and only 5 of them made it there, you know, because they broke on the way.
How many takes was it to do that? You may not remember that.
I don't remember, but I was going to say, I think at least 3. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the casting,
the choices? Well, Russell Hornsby I'd worked with in Edmund as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really liked the idea of working. You know, I was very impressed with him in that film. In Edmund, he had a tiny part. He played a shill in a three-card Monte game. And it's a David Mamet script. And one of the things that Mamet, you know, everyone knows is that you cannot start throwing in extra lines in a David Mamet script. But when we shot it, Russell started just throwing in all the stuff. And we were shooting it on a real street corner in downtown L.A., and he was doing routines with all the people that were walking by, and some of it was hilarious, and I left a lot of it in, and I showed it to Mamet, and I was thinking, you know, he's going to freak, and instead he just loved it. He said, this guy's great, and so I told that to Russell. I said, I think, you know, Mamet wants to steal some of your lines, you know? And anyway, when this role, you know, came around, you know, he was the first person I was thinking of.
So what can fans of the film look forward to on the DVD?
Well, I think that there's, you know, of course, you know, the usual things like, you know, we just recorded a commentary track. I know they're going to do an interview with Stephen Ray because he is in Ireland right now, but he's going to be coming to New York and talking about his experiences making the movie. There's a lot of footage that was shot while we were making the film, so that'll be put together for it. And I think they're going to do a piece about the actual case, you know, in Fort Worth, you know, that inspired the movie.
Was there a lot of deleted scenes, or was your vision of the film?
There was not a lot of deleted scenes. There were some deleted shots. There's a couple of, like when you're talking about that fire scene, you know, one of the things we discovered when we got to St. John was that there had been another movie that had been shot there a few months before where they had done a fire that had gotten out of control and had burned down like half a neighborhood. And they were really nervous about us doing the same thing because we were, you know, in the middle of like this residential area. And so the firemen literally had a truck and were standing right next to us while we were shooting. And these guys are all in full gear. And there were a couple of shots where you see them running into the background behind Stephen Ray with their hoses putting out the fire, you know. And I think that'll be on one of the, you know, deleted shot, I guess you could call it.
Also, thinking back to your earlier movies, Reanimator has one of the wildest nude scenes I've ever seen with the decapitated head. What on earth made you think of that all those years ago?
Well, I think it was a very practical thing. It's like, if you're just a decapitated head, how are you going to get it on, you know? It's going to have to be oral sex, I think.
Yeah. We were talking last night, some of us were talking about there's an interesting racial element in Stock.
Yeah.
I found it interesting that it was the immigrant family who ends up carrying him away, you know, and from the boyfriend to the best friend. Can you talk about that? I mean, was this a conscious thing going in, or was it just kind of...
No, it was. Well, in the, you know, the real story, Shante Mallard, the woman who hit Gregory Biggs, is a black woman. And so there was a racial element to the story originally. You know, the and I think one of the reasons that she was afraid to, you know, report it was because she thought, you know, black woman hits a white guy, you know, she's toast. You know, that's the end. And so there was this in the back of our minds all the way through that there was this kind of racial, you know, the idea of the our society being kind of the haves and the have-nots, and that the if you're not white, you know, you're in the have-nots. And that was one of the things we were trying to get across.
Is there a reason you casted Mina instead of a black woman?
Well, the reason was really was because Mina really wanted to do it. You know, Mina got a, you know, read the script pretty early on, and I got a call from her agent saying Mina loves the script and wants to do the part. And I had just worked with her in Edmund, and I thought, great, you know, that's fantastic. And we hadn't written it as a black woman. We had written it as, you know, it was kind of nondescript in the original script. But I sort of got into the idea of making her, that she should be a, like a black wannabe, you know, that she's cornrows and that, you know, all of her friends are black. And then, you know, maybe even she's part black. Who knows? You know, that's kind of, you know, leave that to the audience's imagination.
What's the status of the House of Reanimator project?
Well, I wish I had good news on that, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen, unfortunately.
Can you lie about it?
It's funny. You know, I've been having second thoughts lately because I keep reading about Oliver Stone doing this movie about Bush, and it's like, you know, I kept thinking, well, it's sort of old news if you start doing movies about the Bush administration. You know, by the time this movie would come out, it would, you know, there'd be a new president, and it's sort of like, who cares anymore? But maybe, you know, the people still are kind of intrigued about him. You know, the Bush administration is so audacious, you know, that, you know, maybe people still will be interested. I don't know.
Wouldn't a zombie president be timeless?
Yeah, but I think it has to be kind of the right zombie. You know, it has to be an electable zombie. That's the thing.
Are you, now that you've kind of departed from horror, and Amicus was supposed to do the thing on the doorstep, and you and I have talked about that.
Yeah.
Progressing on that?
Yeah, I'm still working on it. We're casting it now, as a matter of fact.
That's great. When are you guys gearing for
it? We're hoping to be shooting it this fall.
Nice. What can you tell us anything about the Lovecraft fans know what the story is, but can you just talk about the process of adapting it for the screen?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll just give you sort of the setup about it, which is our version of it. In our version, it's about a psychiatrist who gets this patient, this young girl comes in, who he thinks has got multiple personality disorder. And he knows that in all cases of multiple personality, it involves sexual abuse. And so he's very intrigued by this girl, but he's also very sort of drawn to her, and she keeps, one of her personalities keeps trying to seduce him. And eventually he gives in, and he's having sex with her. And he says to her, is this good for you? And she says, well, why don't you see for yourself? And suddenly they switch bodies. And he is now in her body, and she's in his. And this lasts for like a few seconds, and then he's back, and it's like, what the hell happened? And, you know, the story is about, turns out that this girl is actually a sorceress and wants to take over his body for good, and eventually she's going to become him. And that's kind of the setup of the story.
What is it called?
It's called The Thing on the Doorstep, and it's one of I always say it's the only Lovecraft story that he ever wrote that has a strong female character.
Did Dennis adapt it?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Did you have to buy any rights to this story, Stuck, or was it just
Stuck?
Yeah.
No, because it was all based on newspaper accounts, which are public domain.
Sure.
So we didn't
interview the original.
No, we did not interview anyone. No.
What was your experience doing the Fear Itself episode?
I actually had a really good time doing it, and I was kind of amazed at how, you know, it was funny because I thought when it was going to go to NBC that we would have to cut out all the gore and so forth and mayhem, and they sent me the script, and I was like, I can't believe that they are going to do this on TV. It's because it's pretty explicit.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Yeah, and I was also, you know, I showed the rough cut to my wife, And she said, they're never going to show this on television. And they are. They're going to, you know, they will.
Have you found that television's gotten a lot more lax and it's movies that have gotten more strict these days?
No, I think actually movies have gotten real. I don't think lax is the word I would use. I would say that there's less censorship, which is a good thing. And, you know, that they're letting audiences make up their own minds, you know, which I think is great. And I think that television does, you know, is sort of following in that direction. You know, it's kind of, especially cable TV.
You know. Was the budget of an NBC show a luxury to you, or what?
No, it was. I mean, the budget on the show is not high. It's just, you know, it's fairly low budget, and we had less time to shoot it than the Masters of Horror. You know, we had 8 days to do it, the episode. I had a great leading lady in that, Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men, and she, you know, she was terrific.
Nobody's approached you, Brian, about getting a remake or anything like that?
No. I mean, it's funny, every now and then there'll be a call from somebody asking about
just
it.
Sniffing around.
Yeah.
Say no.
Well, it's not my call, it's really Brian's.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah,
oh,
it
okay.
is.
So what else are you working on, or what else are you developing?
Oh, gosh. Got a couple of things kind of cooking. I don't really want to say too much because, you know, I hate it when you talk about something and then it doesn't happen. So when something interesting is going on, I'll let you know.
Are you thinking of maybe making the film version of Screw Theater?
Well, Screw Theater was... it's funny you should mention that. I'm one of the last, actually it was the last production of Screw Theater, was a production I did of Peter Pan,
right,
which ended up getting me arrested. And I'm actually starting, I just started a script about that, writing about that.
When you mentioned pirates, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, Captain Hook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could do Screw Theater as a movie, just lock everyone in the movie theater. And do the same thing.
Yeah.
This is also Stuck seemed to be like a very economical movie. You had few locations. Was it a very modest budget out of just because it didn't demand a huge budget, except for your performers? It seemed to be only a couple locations.
Well, I think when we started writing it, we kind of realized that it was something that could be done fairly inexpensively.
How long was the shoot?
The shoot was. I want to say it was like 25 days, something like that.
What did you shoot on? It's a DV.
No, it's film. Oh. It was shot in 35 millimeter. But the DP, Dennis Maloney, what we were trying for was a real sort of a documentary feeling. You know, and he's the same guy who shot Edmund, which is a very, very different look. But he, you know, he went out of his way to make it look like it was available light and so forth.
Are you putting any of your older films out on Blu-ray high def?
Again, it's not, you know, this. I wish I could say yes because it's like, but unfortunately I don't have any rights to any of my films. You know, when you make movies, you sign those all away to, you know, it's interesting, you know, a lot of my movies, you know, it's a small company that initially does it and then that company gets taken over by a bigger company and then so forth. So a lot of my films are now at like MGM and, it's really, you know, I have no control over what happens with them.
Let's talk the marketing for Stuck. Like, I love the new poster, and it's obviously a lot different than the old ones. Do you guys kind of want to channel that, like, real-life story stuff in the new poster?
That was actually Think Film's idea, you know, to do a tabloid-style poster, and I liked it. I thought it was good. Because I think it's kind of, you know, it's so different from the others that it'll sort of stand out. I mean, that's the thing about when you're doing a little movie like this, you want to do something that's going to, you know, get attention. So I like that idea.
What's your greatest fear?
My greatest fear? Oh, my. I guess it's all of our greatest fear, death. Huh? Isn't that the greatest fear? Which is what all horror movies are about.
And bad box office. What kind of challenge is it for Stephen Ray? Obviously, he's not here to talk about his role, but that's a challenging part. He must have been stuck in that window. How did that all work out with makeup, and how many days was he in that?
He was in the windshield for 3 weeks. That's what he, you know, he said. He said the real guy was in it for 3 days. I've been in it for 3 weeks, you know. And he always would say, you know, I know my lines today. help, help me, help me.
did he get dizzy? And
he did, because he's literally, you know, his head is like lower than the rest of his body. And it was very hard for him. And you know, it was one of these things where, you know, he'd have to go through, like you said, 3 hours of makeup every day before we even put him into the windshield.
And how did he come into this role? Such an interesting role, an interesting cast.
He is a fantastic actor, you know. And I mean, I've been loving his work for years and wanting to work with him. And somebody suggested that we send him the script, and he just really liked it. You know, he immediately said, yes, I'm in. And he knew, you know, we've talked about it a lot, because he was like bitching about, oh no, I got to go into that windshield again. And I said, well, come on, this, you know, what did you think? We're going to be... We're going to CG you into it, you know. He goes, I know, but you know, doing it's a little different than thinking about doing it. But he was incredible. And one of the things about his performance that I really like is that he really makes you feel it. You know, he makes the audience really feel the pain. And so many movies, and I think this is one of my big beefs about a lot of horror films, is that people are stabbed or they're shot or they're whatever, and you never get any sense of anyone being in pain, you know, and how much this would hurt. You know, it's almost like we're not going to do that because that's too upsetting.
Well, they didn't even bleed till Sam Peckinpah. Yeah,
I know.
Crossover.
Yeah, no, it's true. And that's why it kills me, you know, in TV when they want to not show the blood. You know, sort of like, look, you've got, if you're going to show violence, let's show the way it really is. It's one of the things I really liked about it. It was funny, I was just watching Reservoir Dogs the other day, and that scene with Tim Roth in the beginning when he's been shot. It's like, how many times have you seen a person shot in a movie? About 3 billion times. And here's Tim Roth, she was shot, and you really feel how painful it is. And he's crying and he's screaming, and it's really disturbing. You get physically sick just watching it. And you know, it makes you realize how rare it is that you see somebody playing the pain.
Beginning of the movie, you had the crazy rap song against the old song. Originally in the script, or was that like a post-production move?
It was a post-production move, completely, because originally the music I had was Some Enchanted Evening, played by Mantovani, you know? You know, sort of like the kind of music you'd hear in a real old people's home, you know? And it was like, the whole audience started falling asleep, you know? It was like, it was my editor, Andy Horvich, who said, why don't we try putting a rap song in there? Because we had all these rap songs, you know, later in the movie, and it worked like a charm. I was like completely amazed. And my only regret was that I didn't have her wearing an iPod or something, you know, so we could sort of give a reason for it.
Was that the dirtiest of all the songs you had?
Well,
it is,
but you know what we originally used was the song When the Shit Goes Down, You Better Be Ready.
Speaking of the shit going down, we probably have one of the most indelible, memorable images of shock and horror that we've ever seen in a horror film was the guy with the Depends in his bed with like, oh.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's one of the great metaphors for the movie, what's to come. But where did that come from? Where was it? Original script?
It was in the original script, and it was one of those things I had to fight for because some of the producers were going, you can't show this. This is disgusting, you know. And I said, no, it's really important because you've got to show that this is what she does every day.
Yes.
This is what her life is like, you know. And this is why when just the dangling that promotion in front of her is so important to her, because it's a chance to get away from that, you know. And so you've got to show that. You know, it was important, you know. So that's why it's there.
Yeah.